Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to Africa Link this Friday, the 8th of June 2018. I'm Eunice Onjiro.
With me, Jane Ayeke Kumet. And if you're on the road or for some reason cannot get to your traditional radio set, no worries. You can listen to the program on our Facebook page, DW Africa.
In today's edition, ICC, the International Criminal Court, acquits Congolese politician Jean-Pierre Bemba of war crimes and crimes against humanity.
As a result of this judgment on Mr. Bemba's appeal, the appeals chamber unanimously considers the appeals lodged by Mr. Bemba and the prosecutor against the sentencing decision to be moot.
And DW had an exclusive interview with Nigeria's former governor of Cross River State, Donald Duke, who wants to run for the next elections in Nigeria.
I believe that I have what it takes, the requisite will and exposure, a clear vision in my mind where we ought to be at this time to get this country back on track. Currently, we're on the brink.
Those stories plus your comments coming up after this round of World News.
I'm Shay Meineke with DW News. The International Criminal Court on Friday overturned war crimes against Congolese politician Jean-Pierre Bemba, with the presiding judge ruling that Bemba could not be held responsible for alleged crimes carried out by troops under his control in neighboring Central African Republic. Mark Ellis, executive director of the International Bar Association, said the decision would majorly impact the victims.
The appeals court's decision to reverse any of the decisions made by the trial chamber, I think, would be seen as being quite serious and obviously devastating for the victim. It will depend on exactly what the reversals were.
The former vice president of the Democratic Republic of Congo had been sentenced to 18 years in prison in 2016 for crimes including murder and rape. The World Health Organization has said the Ebola outbreak in the DRC is stabilizing. WHO Chief Tedros Ghebreyesus repeated his cautiously optimistic stance, saying on Friday that he would travel to the DRC over the weekend to check on progress made there and in neighboring Central African Republic. The WHO has vaccinated more than 1,000 people over the past 2 weeks. A total of 38 people have contracted the virus. 13 have died. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has welcomed officials for the G7 Economic Summit in Quebec, Canada, where leaders of the UK, France, Italy, Japan, and Germany voiced concern over U.S. President Donald Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum. Speaking before his arrival, Trump defended his trade stance, but said a new deal could still be made.
We're going to deal with the unfair trade practices. If you look at what Canada, Mexico, the European Union, all of them have been doing to us for many, many decades. We have to change it. If we're unable to make a deal, we'll terminate NAFTA. We'll have a better deal. If we are unable to make a deal, we will be better off right now. That being said, I think we'll probably very easily make a deal.
This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. Hundreds of thousands of people have held a gay pride demonstration in Tel Aviv, Israel, on Friday, chanting slogans and toting flags in support for the annual lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender parade. Around 250,000 people are said to have marched for the event, which went ahead peacefully. And along Israel's Gaza Strip, nearly 100 Palestinians were injured in separate demonstrations against Israeli occupation. The Gaza Health Ministry said the Palestinians were injured by live fire and tear gas in clashes with Israeli forces. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu justified the use of live firing, saying Thursday that other means were not effective. And finally, American TV celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain has died at the age of 61. Bourdain was found dead in France on Friday while working on a food and travel-focused television series for American news network CNN. The station called his death a suicide. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
This is DW's Africa Link program with me, Jane Ayeko Kumet.
And I'm Eunice Wanjiro. As always, you can listen to Africa Link live on our DW Facebook page, that's DW Africa, and send your comments to the stories that we are airing, and we shall read them as whenever possible. Now, the International Criminal Court has acquitted Congolese politician Jean-Pierre Bemba of war crimes and crimes against humanity, adding that there was no considerable evidence to implicate Bemba. Presiding Judge Christine van der Weingart said that Bemba could not be held responsible for atrocities carried out by troops under his control in neighboring Central African Republic, and that trial judges had failed to consider the efforts he made to stop crimes once he became aware of them.
As a result of this judgment on Mr. Bemba's appeal, the appeals chamber unanimously considers the appeals lodged by Mr. Bemba and the prosecutor against the sentencing decision to be moot and dismisses them as such. This concludes the summary of judgments in this case.
And that ruling is just a few minutes old. It just happened a few minutes before we came on air. Now, Bemba, a former vice president of the Democratic Republic of Congo, had been sentenced to 18 years in prison in June 2016 for alleged crimes, including murder and rape. Mark Ells, executive director at the International Bar Association in London, has been telling me what this means for the victims.
I believe that the decision by the appeals chamber to overturn the trial conviction of Bemba is a real serious issue for justice in general. This was one of the most important cases in front of the International Criminal Court because it dealt with this concept of command responsibility, superior responsibility. And the fact now that the appeals court has decided that there was an error on the trial chamber's part in convicting the accused means that this is a real devastating decision for the victims of this very horrendous conflict that occurred. We will have to see what happens ultimately as the appeals chamber decision is reviewed by legal scholars as to how this is going to have an impact on future cases when it deals with this issue of command responsibility.
This is certainly a big blow to the victims. What do you think is going to happen to them?
Well, unfortunately, if this decision stands, and it will stand, that the victims are going to feel as if justice was not done, because there's no question of the evidence that was submitted in this case was quite significant, and it was not hundreds of victims, it was thousands of victims, including some of the most heinous crimes of rape against women and children. And so this will have a devastating impact for victims. But if the appeals court made the decision that the trial court simply erred in interpreting the legal requirement of determining whether somebody in a command position, like the accused, and the trial chamber erred in that, then that's a very unfortunate situation. And again, I think it will have an impact. It will definitely have an impact on future cases as to how this principle of command responsibility is seen.
Mark Ellis, executive director at the International Bar Association in London.
Now, could it be a war of words brewing between France and US? Well, the French president Emmanuel Macron has warned Washington that it could face isolation over trade tariffs. As the G7 summit kicks off in Canada, Washington's European allies are bracing for a showdown with Donald Trump. They are now open to getting new allies ready to uphold the multilateral world order.
Germany's foreign minister Heiko Maas said Europe could be united. A united Europe is the only answer to US, adding that nothing that President Donald Trump was doing would make the world better, safe or more peaceful. On the other hand, French president, who has tried to be friendly to Trump in the past, made it clear that the other six countries at the G7 meeting would gladly sign a deal without Trump. Now, on whether or not this could be the last G7 summit in its current form, here is DW's Bernd Rigert in Brussels.
Certainly the stage is set now for a massive display of this transatlantic divide from a European perspective and also from a Canadian perspective. Donald Trump is acting like a wrecking ball on the international stage now, and there's disagreement in almost every point that the G7 is normally talking about. If it comes to trade, if it comes to climate change, if it comes to foreign policy, there's no common ground anymore, and it's very likely that there will be no common resolution or common statement after this G7 summit, but only a declaration made by Trudeau, the host of the summit.
DW's Ben Rigard in Brussels.
Now, next year in February, Nigerians will go to the polls to elect a president. The current president, Muhammadu Buhari, has already declared his intention to run for a second term. DW's Adrian Kersh met somebody who is willing to contest Buhari's position. Take a listen.
For me, the challenge Nigeria faces at this time is one that we can no longer sit back and criticize. We've got to strive to put our best foot forward. And I believe that I have what it takes, the requisite will and exposure, a clear vision in my mind where we ought to be at this time to get this country back on track. Currently, we're on the brink.
Now, you have been a member of the PDP, the People's Democratic Party, that has been running the country for many years until it was defeated in the last election. But you're also a member of the Coalition for Nigeria movement, a movement that was started by former head of state Olusegun Obasanjo. We understand this is rather a movement, but with the possibility to get into a political party. Under which party or movement are you planning to run for presidency?
The field is evolving. The opposition parties are discussing with each other to try to come up with a formidable opposition group. So I don't want to preempt what is happening. I'm still a member of the PDP. But the evolution would determine the nature of the platform. But regardless of what it is, I would be running.
But what makes you optimistic that you will be the chosen one? A lot of other people might be interested as well.
Well, if I run, I might lose. But if I don't, I'm guaranteed to lose. In this business, you can't sit back and postulate. It's like a casino. You don't know if you'll win, except you're part of the race. But I'll put myself forward.
Do you have the backing of Olusegun Obasanjo, the former head of state who started the movement and who is considered as a kingmaker still in the country?
I don't have the backing of an individual. I have the goodwill and support of a vast number of people. And that's what matters. An individual has only one vote. And I don't want to portray myself in that light. I want to be the people's candidate. And that's the desire I seek.
Why do you think you would be a better president than Muhammadu Buhari?
Because I see such obvious failings. I see a leadership that is steeped in the past, that has refused to evolve with a nation that is predominantly a nation of young, aspiring people and still doing things the way they were done many, many years ago and did not work. I think our leadership in the country today is totally out of tune with the current realities of our nation. There's a disconnect somewhere.
That is Donald Duke, Nigeria's former governor of Cross River State, in an exclusive interview with DW. Donald Duke is a member of the major opposition party PDP and the Coalition for Nigerian Movement, but he has not confirmed which platform he will run under.
Interesting there. I remember last week, or rather, I'm not quite so sure, but I think it was last week that President Buhari actually signed into law a new bill allowing young people, or rather reducing the number, the age limit within which somebody can contest for president. He actually brought it down to 35.
Yes, I remember.
It's going to be an interesting race for Nigeria anyway. Some other story that we've been covering on is what is called the crisis countries. Now, the Norwegian Refugee Council has come up with a list of what accounts or what happens to be crisis countries. And majority of them are in Africa. So we've been asking you what you think about this and why many of these countries are found in Africa.
And Arnold Panti has commented on our Facebook page. He's saying the conflicts in Africa are totally of our own making. We should not blame others when we Africans mess up. Take my country, Cameroon, for example. Once a nice and beautiful country, but on its way to becoming another banana republic.
Well, he goes on to say, as a consequence of very poor leadership, nothing to do with the colonial past. An interesting one there. Nana Yawe says, I may disagree with the report because we know of Yemen and Syria in the Middle East, but if Africa is the most neglected conflict, then so be it. That's all we had for this time. We will certainly read your comments a little shortly, but definitely, for now, we'll take a short break. You're listening to Africa Link, coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany. I'm Jane Ayeko-Kumet.
And I'm Eunice Wanjiro. Remember, we are also live on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Coming up in the next 15 minutes, the International Organization for Migration repatriates 130 Liberian migrants from North Africa. We'll hear from some of the returnees.
I went to Libya. I was trying to find my way to go to Italy.
I went to Libya. I was trying to find my way to Italy. But because the Arab people were so wicked to us, the blacks, I found it difficult to leave from Libya.
And on African roots this week, we hear about Ngungunyane, who was the last king of the second biggest empire in Africa during the 19th century.
But let's first head to Liberia, where 130 Liberian migrants have arrived after being deported from Libya, Niger, Mali, Algeria and Tunisia. They were taken to Agadez for preparation to return home. Agadez in Niger is used by the International Organization for Migration, the IOM, as a transit center for migrants.
Now, among the Liberian migrants who were on board the flight that landed at the country's international airport are young men as well as women and children. Evelyn Paddy was at the airport and sent us this report.
On a charter flight from Abadi in Niger, 130 stranded Liberian migrants arrived at the Rabat International Airport. The International Organization on Migration, in collaboration with the Liberia Refugee Repatriation and Resettlement Commission, facilitated the returns of the migrants. Among them were women and children. Nuku Kobo, a mother of two, shares her story.
I was taken from Algeria.
I was taken from Algeria and brought to Niger, and I was standing right in front of my apartment when the police picked me up. They were deporting all the blacks, especially Liberians. I was happy when the flight landed because there is nowhere like home. In Algeria, we were mostly in the house. When you even want to go buy food, you have to hide.
A majority of the returnees are young men. Bwaika Momo managed to cross over into Libya with the hope of traveling to Europe, but things turned out differently, just like it did for Alex Laman.
I went to Libya. I was trying to find my way to go to Italy.
I went to Libya. I was trying to find my way to Italy, but because the Arab people were so wicked to us, the blacks, I found it difficult to leave from Libya. I was hustling on my own, and I left and came to Algeria. While in Algeria for a period of time, we were arrested and deported to Liberia today. Life there is common if you are hardworking and law-abiding, but it was still difficult because of racism and discrimination.
Discrimination. I'm very happy, but I guess something to tell the people that call themselves white.
I am very happy, but I have something to say to those who call themselves white, more especially the Algerians. Everything we worked for, they took it from us and threw us into the desert. We walked 25 kilometers, no water and no food. But we thank God for IOM that brought us back to Liberia.
Mr. Kablas Ami, IOM's chief of mission to Liberia, has been telling Africa Link about IOM's intervention in getting the migrants to Liberia.
The Liberians contacted IOM from the desert. The migrants were heading towards Algeria, Tunisia, Libya, with the hope of crossing the Mediterranean to Europe. Freedom of movement, which is an inherent right. IOM, with this ongoing project, is to support the feeding and lodging of stranded migrants who have been contacted and been supported. The transit center, IOM has about 6 transit centers in Niger.
Though the European Union is still struggling to curb the influx of Africans into Europe, the lack of opportunity and poverty is a major factor leading Africans, including Liberians, to abandon their countries, risking their lives through the Mediterranean Sea to get to Europe.
Evelyn Pade reporting.
DW African Roots.
Now, before we go to our African roots, I'd like to acknowledge those of you listening to us on our Facebook page, Ambrose Koech, Kwesi Dapa, Tabu Patrick, and Igwe Donald. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, and on African Roots today, we hear about Ngungu Nyane, who was the last king of Gaza, the second biggest empire in Africa, during the 19th century. His legacy is contested. Although he stood up against the Portuguese colonial power, he himself is also criticized for his colonialist way of dominating others.
Decades after his death in the Portuguese deportation, the memory of the forgotten king was revived as a symbol against European imperialism. Michael Wambi presents this report by Gloria Souza.
Several battles led to the establishment of the Gaza Empire in Southeast Africa, the second biggest empire in Africa during the 19th century. Amidst violence and betrayal, Ngungu Nyane, also known as the Lion of Gaza, rose to power in 1884. Yeah! The last king of Gaza, Ngungu Nyane, ruled for 11 years. His empire covered much of what is today South Mozambique. His reign coincided with the climax of the European appetite for Africa. In this context, Ngungu Nyane proved to be a skillful diplomat, says Mozambique writer Mia Kuto.
He was able to take advantage from internal conflicts and also from the influence of the different colonial powers. He played with England and Portugal, making alliances that were later renegotiated. I think he was extremely clever in terms of power management.
The Gaza Empire was marked by hunger for power and violence against the different ethnic groups, stresses the German historian and professor in Mozambique, Gerhard Lisgang.
The name Ngungu Nyane was also used as someone who did not obey the laws. Thus, his reputation was not that of a fair king, of one who terrorizes his own country.
In the long run, the Gaza kingdom was overpowered by the Portuguese invaders. After several battles, Ngungu Nyane was defeated by the colonial forces in 1895 and arrested in Chiamati, the location where his grandfather, the empire's founder, was buried. At the time, the last king of Gaza had already lost royalty of many of his own people. Ngungu Nyane and his entourage were brought to Lisbon, where they were publicly exhibited and then transferred to the Terceira island on the Azores archipelago. While imprisoned, he learned to read and write and was forcibly converted to Christianity. Ngungu Nyane died of cerebral hemorrhage on December 23, 1906. His story could have ended there. For decades after his death, Ngungu Nyane sank into oblivion. But then, nearly 70 years later, independence was won for the state of Mozambique, and one man remembered the last king of Gaza, explains historian Gerhard Lisgang.
There is a historical incident. The first president of Mozambique was born in Gaza, and during the civil war against RENAMO, he thought it was good to have a Mozambican hero as a role model.
Ngungu Nyane's portrait by Gloria Souza was brought to you as a part of our special series African Roots, a project realized in cooperation with the Gerda Henkel Foundation. And now, as usual on Friday, it's time for sports. We are now counting down to the World Cup 2018 taking place in Russia. It kicks off in less than a week's time. And before we came on air, I spoke to Chuck Penfold from DW's sports desk, and I wanted to find out from him how the preparations were going on.
Well, from everything I've heard from our correspondent in Moscow, in terms of the preparations of the organizers, everything is in place, and everything's pretty much ready to go. There's been a lot of talk in the headlines about concerns about people going there because of security, but the Russians are assuring that that's all in place and they're well prepared for. The head of FIFA security, in fact, came out this week and said that he's completely satisfied with the preparations. So Russia, Vladimir Putin, the president, are saying, you know, come to Russia, everything's going to be friendly and you'll be secure and you'll have a good time.
Well, that's good to hear. And what about the teams that are playing in this World Cup? How are they preparing for this?
Well, everybody held somewhere or other held a training camp for, you know, a week or 2 weeks or more. Usually they leave their country or leave the main city at least and go away and get away from things a little bit. But Germany, for example, had a two-week training camp in Eppan in South Tyrol, which is actually northern Italy. And head coach Joachim Löw and general manager Oliver Bierhoff said they were very pleased with how they were received there and how the training camp went, and that they're almost prepared for the World Cup, but maybe sort of the last edge is still needed. The really good news for Germany was that their captain, Manuel Neuer, the number one goalkeeper, came back because he'd been injured for almost the whole season since September when he fractured his foot. And he came back and made his first start in a sort of competitive game. It was a friendly against Austria, but that was last weekend. Germany lost 2-1, which is a bit embarrassing for Germany against their smaller southern rivals. But the good news was that Manuel Neuer looked like his old self, despite not having played a competitive match for however many months that was. And one concern with Mesut Özil, who's a bit injured, a bruised knee, he's not going to play in the Saudi Arabia match, which is the last one before the World Cup. But everything looks to be going according to plan for Germany.
Now let's stick with Germany. This team, football team, Die Mannschaft, is having its final test this evening with a friendly clash with Saudi Arabia. What are people saying, especially after they lost to Austria?
I think there's a sense now that this is the last match before their next match, which will be their opener of the World Cup on June 17th. So I think there's a sense that he wants a reaction from his team after that loss, that he wants a comfortable victory. He's going to be fielding the best team he can probably tonight, whereas that was a little bit different. He'd been resting a couple of players who'd played late into the season for the Austria match. So I think the hope is that Germany will come out with a clear victory tonight. And I don't know if they need to build their confidence. They haven't won in five games, which is seems a bit unusual for defending title holders. But I think the sense is they need a good, solid victory tonight to give them confidence going into the World Cup next week.
I was speaking to Chuck Penfold there. Now, we're looking forward to this World Cup 2018.
Of course, everybody's looking forward to it.
We'll see whether the German team can defend its title.
Yeah, that's a good one. But let's go back to this Liberia story that some Liberians who had been in Libya were finally taken back home. And of course, we heard those voices there. Some of them were quite excited, saying there is no better place like home. And we posted on our Facebook page asking why some African countries are not doing enough for their citizens who are in some kind of limbo in Libya. These are some of the comments that you've been sending. From Sierra Leone, Kamara said, because they don't see their citizens as their subjects.
And Kachenge Sambr saying, a very good action from the leadership of Liberia. A big thanks to President George Weah.
And Nyamba says, wow, Mr. Weah is at least trying. DW, I'm not blaming the West. Of course, our leaders have made us beggars of the world. But please, on the other side, we are badly informed on this continent and the many reasons that the media houses like yours only portray a paradise that exists in the West and big poverty in Africa. Could you take part in the campaign by showing videos that help people understand Africa better? Thank you very much, Nyamba, for that comment. We certainly take it seriously and we shall do our best.
And Johnson Bono, lastly, he's saying good job to the pro-poor government of His Excellency George M. Weah.
And a quick recap. Yesterday, we did cover a story about the findings of Ghana's investigative journalist, Anas. And you people are still commenting on his findings. John from Cameroon says, I don't think so. When you are a person that doesn't take a bribe, no matter what amount it is, you will not take it. It's about a question of some people who take very minimal bribes.
And Hassan Saidu from Ghana is saying Ghanaians are scared of his method of investigation because he comes out not just news, but pure evidence, in this case, tapes of his victims. Anas is a true corruption fighter.
And we do encourage you to continue sending your comments by visiting our DW Facebook page and share your opinion. That's all from me, Jane Ayego-Kumet.
And I'm Eunice Onjiro. Have a lovely weekend.